Susie Thorpe
on Cambridge 105 Radio.
I've been speaking to Taff Gillingham. He is co-founder of Khaki Devil, and it's a mission to improve the military historical accuracy of films and TV and theatre. And also, he's now doing another project, which is called Great War Huts, and it's based in Bury St Edmunds. And it's a project to keep together, well, literally to rebuild some of the huts and make a visitor centre for First World War huts, to give you a bit of history to that. And also, he's going to be putting in a trench for everyone, the public, to visit at the moment. And I asked him right at the beginning, I said, how on earth did he ever get into this?
When everybody else got into football and other things, even if I sort of got interested in other things, I kept all the old uniforms I'd got and things like that. And never sort of sold all the bits off and lost interest altogether. Sort of growing up in the sort of early 70s and 80s, there was a lot of veterans still to talk to, so you could actually go and ask them. You know, didn't just need to read about it. My dear old mum would say, oh, all that old army rubbish, that will never do you any good, you know. Why don't you get rid of that? And actually, it did. It proved to be really useful in the end, and now it helps pay my wages. So that was the sort of the real origins of it. And, I mean, my grandfather had fought in the First World War. Dad only just missed the Second War. OK, so Khaki Devil was founded in 2001, actually. I mean, I suppose, winding back a bit from that, I'd given historical advice for film, television and theatre work, going back to the mid-90s, when Will Boyd, the author, got me involved in his film The Trench. But in 2001... the BBC made a series also called The Trench, where we took 25 or 30 fellas from Hull and we trained them as First World War soldiers and took them to France. And basically, they had to live for 5 weeks in a trench system in France. And just as a throwaway comment, at the end of the interview, when they'd taken me on as the advisor, I said, so where are you going to get all the gear? And they said, oh, we're going to hire it. And I said, well, you can't, you know, for what you want to do. It's not like getting threadbare gear that you can get from any costume hire company. This is... you know, they're going to need two pairs of pants, three pairs of socks, everything that soldiers would have at the time. And it's got to be new, it's got to be in good condition. And just on a whim, I just said, if you're interested, my mate and I will set up a company to do all that. We won't do a bit of it, we'll either do all of it or none of it. And the deal is that we'll hire it to you for what it costs us to hire it or have it made, or buy it or have it made. And in the end, we get it all back for free. And they said, no, that's an outrageous abuse of licence payers' money. And I said, fair enough, and thought that was the end of it. But a week later, they rang me back and said, oh, we can't find this anywhere. Can you get on with it? That was 2001, and since that time, we've just amassed a huge amount of uniforms, equipment, weapons, props. We've got a team of a couple of hundred or so specialist extras that we call upon to do sort of big crowd scenes. You name it, really. And having got this sort of complete package, which certainly for documentary makers who've seen their budgets cut and cut and cut over the years, it saves them an awful lot of money. And then having got all of that, they then started saying to us, well, we want someone to film it. And we started off building trenches for specific jobs. So Blue Peter or someone like that would ring us up, and we'd go up to North Yorkshire and we'd build a trench for 3 days, 2 days filming it, bulldoze it all for another day, and then bring everything back to Suffolk and just thought, this is a bit mad. Why don't we build one here? So we ended up building a trench system in on the outskirts of Ipswich, which people like Downton Abbey and the latest Journey's End film and things like that, they all come to Suffolk especially to film it. We would get inundated with people ringing us up or emailing saying, oh, fantastic, can I bring the kids to look at it? Can I bring the WI? Can I just come and see it? And you can't, because we don't have planning permission for the public. What we ought to do is find somewhere that we could build a proper First War Visitors Centre where people who do want to learn can come and have a look. It was about 4 or 5 years of looking when eventually Tracy found Brook Farm here at Horsted. There's plenty of room for trenches, but crucially, there was a flat plateau with enough room to build 11 replica First World War Army huts. So
and,
that we
and
could
we're
have...
looking at these now, aren't yeah. we, some of them? I mean, I do feel as if we're in a film set. it is pretty amazing.
The logic said if you're going to have a First World War Visitors Centre, you need to have First World War buildings to display them in. And the assumption from the start was that they were going to need to be replicas because, you know, they're going to have to last a long time and surely there can't be many First War buildings around. And no sooner had we got planning permission for replica huts than we started finding real ones. We got the press involved. There were newspaper stories. It ran on radio and television. And then the phone started ringing. And people would ring me up and say, oh, hello, we're Great Hawksley Women's Institute. We've got one. It's a bit of a millstone. Will you take it away? Oh, hello, my mum's just died. She's been living in one. Would you like that? And we were literally being offered them at the rate of one a month to begin with.
And one in particular, of course, in Cambridge.
Absolutely. Well, that's a really, really interesting one. It's the one we're working on at the moment.
It
is. It's the one that's in frame form.
Can we walk over there?
Yeah, certainly. Girton Women's Institute contacted us and said, oh, we've been reading in the WI magazine that you've been rescuing these huts, because we'd already got one that had come from another WI group. And they said, we've got one which we're in the process of selling. They're going to pull it down and build little almshouses here for sort of young people in Girton to live in. And Girton Town Charity are buying it off us and are going to convert the space. And so it's got to go. So we went and had a look and thought, actually, it was in remarkably good condition, because a lot of them really aren't. A lot of them are just literally not worth saving. But it was covered in corrugated tin. From what we could see of the frame inside, it was all in pretty good order. It all got its original wooden matchboarding on the inside as well. So we agreed to start saving it. As we started dismantling the inside, we started stripping the boards off and started revealing the timber frame. And I had a message from an American lady called Carrie Draper, who was an architecture student at Cambridge. She was in the process of writing her PhD. And the subject of a PhD was temporary British military wooden buildings of the two world wars, which was fantastic. And she said, oh, my goodness, that's an Armstrong hut. Major Armstrong was the Royal Engineers officer who, in August 1914, he and his small team were given the job of designing every type of building that an army camp could possibly want, from barrack huts to latrines to stable blocks, all sorts. It's a very specific design. Now, very, very few huts which have survived are Armstrong huts. So suddenly we realised that it was quite an unusual and interesting hut. Now, we'd got some history from the Women's Institute at Girton, because they bought it in 1920. It had come from Cherry Hinton. And it was, when they bought it, it was Cherry Hinton Hospital, which was closing down. It was an army hospital, and it was specifically a VD hospital, of which there were many scattered all over the country. The venereal disease had been a massive problem for the British Army in the First War, and it had been hugely controversial in Cherry Hinton, to the point when it became a VD hospital at the outbreak, that the local residents had insisted that they wanted barbed wire put around it to stop the inmates getting out and all sorts of things like that. And that hadn't bothered the ladies at Girton WI. They just wanted a nice wooden hut. So that was moved up from Cherry Hinton to Girton in the 1920s and put back up again. Having had this message from Carrie Draper that it was a really early hut, I got home and I sat in the car outside the house and I just thought, there's something a bit odd about that, because if it's as early as she says it is, and the fact it was covered in corrugated tin, she said, well, that's got to be a September, October, November 1914 hut. I couldn't think that there was any chance that that early on, in September, October 1914, that the pressing need for the army was VD hospitals. What they desperately needed to do then was find accommodation. Because actually this whole project in 1914 and early 1915, to get 850,000 men out from under canvas and into proper wooden barrack huts, I mean, that literally, even today, is still the largest building project that's ever been undertaken in Britain. It was absolutely massive. You know, it can't have been a hospital originally. And then I started digging around into my memory banks and remembered that I'd been on a tour earlier in the year, a battlefield tour, with a fellow called Phil Kerm. And Phil's the expert on the 11th Battalion of the Suffolk Regiment, which, I mean, the Suffolk Regiment's a real pet thing of mine as well. I've got a passion about the Suffolks for many years. But something Phil had mentioned, that when the battalion was first formed in Cambridge in 1914, to begin with, they'd been billeted in a couple of the schools, I think Melbourne Road School, I think it was a county school, I think were the two schools it had been in. And then he'd said that they'd moved to a specially built camp at Cherry Hinton. So I started digging around and found that, sure enough, the camp that had been built at Cherry Hinton was built specifically for the 11th Battalion of the Suffolk Regiment, who were called the Cam Suffolks. They were all men from Cambridgeshire originally. The Cambridgeshire Regiment actually started life in 1908, and there was no sort of earlier history to it, because it had been the 3rd Volunteer Battalion of the Suffolk Regiment. There'd never been any proper regular infantry in recent times in Cambridgeshire. So the Cambridgeshire Regiment were a wholly owned subsidiary of the Suffolk Regiment, so there was a sort of Suffolk Regiment heritage to all things Cambridgeshire military. In 1914, the Cambridgeshire territorials, who already existed, were already overwhelmed with the amount of volunteers. A lot of men had walked to Bury St Edmunds to join the Suffolk Regiment, and there wasn't space for them there either. Bury St Edmunds, the CO, commanding officer of the depot at Bury, said, look, tell you what, get yourselves back to Cambridge, go to Cambridge Corn Exchange and we'll send some officers and sort you out. And that was how the 11th Battalion started life. It was very unusual for them to have a camp of their own. In fact, we can't think of another instance. Nearly all camps that were being built at that time, in September, October 1914, were built for infantry brigades or infantry divisions, so either 4 or 12 or more, you know, army units. And to have a camp specifically built for the 11th Suffolk is very rare. So what's great about this is that we know whose it was. We know who were in it.
I mean, you don't know why it was built just for them, then. You don't know the reason why they had a...
Well, Phil Kerm had got the diaries of one of the officers. I think it was a chap called Andrew Wright. And in his diary, he mentions that that the battalion had applied to be able to build a camp of their own or have a camp built for them. And probably coming from Cambridge, they were probably well-connected enough to arrange for that. The idea, it really, is to really probably challenge people's perceptions of the First World War. I mean, you know, I was very privileged. I knew an awful lot of First World War soldiers. And they were always kind of ever so slightly disappointed by the fact that the British public really didn't get what had happened in the First World War, what they'd achieved, and that the British experience of the First World War has been simplified to a point that the old boys almost didn't recognise it. The whole idea here is that people will come here and we will give them all of the bits and pieces and they'll put it together themselves.
But your reputation, though, Taff, is that you are... The one word that comes out in lots of tweets and recommendations is accuracy.
Our mantra has always been it doesn't cost any more to do it properly than it does to do it badly, so why don't you just do it properly in the first place? From a film and television point of view, if you're making a documentary, I'll fight you to the death to tell the truth, or we won't help you at all, because there's no excuse for it. If it's drama, well, OK, fair enough. Drama, you know, there has to be compromise. The starting point has got to be compromise. I mean, it even happened with Journey's End. The art director comes to me and says, right, I want the trench to look like this. And he's bringing me photographs from other films. And why are you doing this? There's plenty of real pictures of real trenches. You don't need to look at somebody's fake trench that says, you know... And the other problem is, if you were, say, making something like Call a Midwife, you go, we're setting it in 1964, they'll go and look at pictures of 1964. If you say the First World War, they go, oh, well, it was all the same. It's all that mud. And there are four or five pictures. You know, the blokes lugging the stretcher through the mud at Pilcombe Ridge, the field gun being dragged out, the mule stuck in the mud. And they have kind of become shorthand for the First World War.
Hundred years this year, 2018,
yes,
to commemorate the end of the First World War, and what a great project, an amazing thing to do.
We thought was really important was all the way through, people said, oh, you're going to have to get it all done before the end of the centenary, but you don't, because actually this isn't about the centenary. The whole point of this is to make people keep thinking about this and keep learning about it long into the future, and in a way the centenary's almost got in the way of that. That the idea of having something that continues to grow and expand. I mean, when we started doing this, I think we all thought, oh, well, we've got to have everything done before we can open the doors and let anybody in. But Richard Van Emden, the military author, who's a great friend, said to me, no, he said, you've got that wrong. He said, I was a student in the 80s in Durham. And he said, I used to go to the museum at Beamish, the big open-air museum, when it had first opened. He said, and there was nothing there. But what was there was fantastic. And every time I go back, there's more of it, and it's bigger, and it's better. He said, and I've been on the journey with them. We deliberately didn't start pushing and promoting this. You had to have got enough of it done so that you could walk in a room like you've just done, and go, oh, right, I get this, you know, oh, and you're capable of doing it. You're not just talking about it. You can take a huge building and move it from one end of the county to the other and put it all back up again and repair it and make it how it would have been 100 years ago.
Because, these buildings are everywhere, but I don't think people realise the history to these.
No, that's true. That's very true. And I think that there's something that, you know, that there are so many modern museums that have gone down the route of putting incredibly modern buildings up and then putting old artifacts in them in little cases. They've got no context with them. They, you know, all these things are now isolated in little glass boxes, And in some places, it's now become more about the buildings they're in rather than the exhibits themselves. And what we're very keen to do here is literally to wind the clock back 30 or 40 years and go, well, do you know what? Everybody says that museums all need modernising for a younger generation. I actually don't buy into that. I've spent a long time designing things for military museums. And I think that part of the problem is that we all go, oh, well, it's all got to be relevant for kids and it's all got to be about touchscreens and all about computers. But if you actually stand in galleries and you watch how people interact with it, the kids come in and they look at all this touchscreen stuff and go, do you know what? This isn't as good as my PlayStation or what I do on my phone. And they walk off and you just get lots of bemused older people who don't know how it works anyway. This is real. This was there. Well, this was actually carried by people 100 years ago. It's always about people. And it's about the things that people carried, how they carry them, things that relate to modern people. So, for instance, we've got an army optician set with all the lenses in, because most people think, oh, we wear glasses. You know, the army wouldn't have wanted us. But then when you research the Army Spectacle Depot, they made something like 450,000 pairs of glasses during the war, which clearly wasn't a service for civilians. So that then takes you on to say, well, where are they all? So you start finding photographs of them, and then you look for stories. I mean, again, Richard Van Emden, I said to him, have you got any stories about men with glasses? And he said, oh, yes, I've got a great tale about an officer who goes out with two men into no man's land on a listening patrol, and they get run up by the German wire, and they've been there for a couple of hours, and then they get spotted, and all hell breaks loose, and they come dashing back across no man's land, and they jump into the trench, and the sergeant major says, where is he? Where's the officer? Oh, blimey. Back out into no man's land, these two fellas go again, rummage around, and they eventually find this officer on his hands and knees because he's dropped his glasses. He can't find them, and they have to pick him up and carry him back because he can't see where he's going. Yeah. So all of these little bits and pieces suddenly say, actually, all those of you that wear glasses that thought this wouldn't be you, no, this is you too. And it's finding those ways which relate to ordinary people. No, none of us have any concept of sticking bayonets into Germans. We just don't.
No.
But all of the other normal, everyday human things which just happen to be done in war zones, all of that you can relate to and make it interesting.
Oh, that was me talking with Taff Gillingham. He is the co-founder of the Great War Huts Project, and he's also part of the Khaki Devil, that is the company that provides historically accurate military uniforms, equipments and weapons and props and historical advice to film, television and theatre. And they're actually making, they're putting war huts in Sudbury in Bury St Edmunds, and they're actually building trenches, and it's going to be a visitor centre and be fantastic. Lots and lots of people have been asking for this for ages and ages, and Khaki Dev have been working on amazing projects like the adaptation of Michael Morpurgo's Private Peaceful, Downton Abbey. I mean, they've done it all, so they know a lot. So when it does actually open, do take a look. Now the website for this is greatwarhuts.org, so you can look on that and see the progress that they're making. And they've got pictures of the huts in situ that they're going to build. One's already been built, a few have been built rather, and they're onto the trenches next. Of course, they're very, very busy at the moment because of the centenary celebration or the commemoration of the 100 War end on Sunday, the 11th of November. But the project is going on, and the website will let you know when it's all open. And I have to tell you, I know for a fact that it will be absolutely amazing.